Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility, that's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Well, hello, wherever you are. Welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. And today, wow, this is a fascinating way to introduce someone. We have a software developer turned actor turned author. I don't know what to say to that except Robert French, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to have to get into this software developer and all of that. Robert and I have had some interesting discussions, among other things, talking about computers. Robert was born in 1944. I was born in 1950. But when Robert was born, and for a while, there were a total of five computers in the world, and they were all within 40 miles of where you were born in England, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, they were at Bletchley Park.
Ah, probably used for decoding or something.
That's right. Yes, they were under the care of the famous Alan Turing.
Right. And of course, we've got a few more computers in the world than that today. But I remember when Robert and I were talking, I pointed out how both of us grew up in a time when a disk crash was really a disk crash. Disks were these large 16-inch platters that you would place into a disk drive, and the heads would flow over the disks, a tiny microscopic amount above the disk. But if something messed up and the head dropped onto the disk drive, it tore it up and it made a wretched noise.
Yes, and all your data was lost.
All of your data was immediately and totally lost. Absolutely. It's pretty amazing. Well, tell me a little bit about you and growing up and so on, and how you got into the whole business of software development and such.
Well, yeah, it was interesting. I was born in the East End of London, which is like the dodgy end of London. Well, I was born actually in Oxford, but brought up in the East End of London, which is the kind of dodgy end of London. My parents sacrificed quite a lot to send me to a good school where I became fascinated with mathematics and wanted to become a mathematician. Then I started reading science fiction, and the idea of computers came up, and I got fascinated with the whole idea of computers. And I made a decision that's where I wanted to place my career. Rather than being a mathematician and working in esoteric arts, I thought I'd rather do something practical with computers. And so I became a computer programmer and did that for a lot of years, almost 50.
I remember Isaac Asimov's UNIVAC.
I actually worked for the company UNIVAC at one point in my career.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Well, yeah. Of course, one of my favorite Isaac Asimov stories, and I heard about it long before I actually was able to read it because it finally got put in a readable form for me, was The Ultimate Question. You're familiar with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And of course, It was. What was the question?
I can't.
Trying to remember. It had to do with entropy. When entropy doesn't expand anymore, or when does entropy reverse? When does entropy reverse? Mm. I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the story goes that there was the UNIVAC, and it progressed and became more powerful, and eventually it lived in hyperspace and was an all-encompassing computer. And every time anyone asked the question about whether entropy could be reversed, the computer always answered, I don't, insufficient data to know the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. Finally, at the very end, the computer said, I have the answer. And the answer to the question was, let there be light.
Yes, that's a great story. Okay. A couple of other Asimov stories have inspired me. One is his robot series. The iRobot. That was one of the things that made me want to be a programmer. He vastly underestimated the time it would take for artificial intelligence to emerge. Right. He missed it by about 50 years, but still pretty good. But another one that really interested me and inspired me was, I've forgotten the name of the actual book, but it was about the planet Aurora, where people didn't meet in person, but they projected images of each other, holographic images of each other. So if you wanted to go for a walk in the woods with a friend, they would walk in their woods, you would walk in yours, and each of you would have a holographic image of the other one walking with you. And in some ways, that was the precursor of the internet.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, and in with iRobot and the series, of course, the three laws of robotics,
he was
very, very creative and clever about mm-hmm. what robots could do and couldn't do. And then, of course, there were a few times that the laws got circumvented, and it turns out it was human error in terms mm-hmm. of instructions to the computers or to the robots mm-hmm. and so on.
Yeah, the three laws of robotics, it's interesting that there are lots of discussions these days in the world of artificial intelligence about the whole issue of how do you control artificial intelligence and how you might put the three laws of robotics into effect. So a lot of people are concerned about artificial intelligence running amok.
Right. Well, and just the whole lack of discipline in a lot of what we do today. Of course, today, everyone wants everything immediately, and they want everything, and they want their so-called freedom, and they don't recognize, which is what the laws of robotics at least addressed, they don't recognize their own responsibility to freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's the old adage, you have no rights without duties.
Correct. So you got into software development. Love to learn a little bit more about that.
Well, I started on obviously mainframe computers. This was in my first job was I started my first job on January the 11th, 1963. And the first computer I worked on was, of course, a mainframe because they were all mainframes. And I worked for years on mainframes. I emigrated from England to Canada in 1971. The original plan is I'd go to Canada for a couple of years and work and then maybe go back to England. And now, 51 years later, I haven't gone back to England, well, not to live anyway. And, you know, I graduated through the mainframes, worked on mini computers, then worked on PCs. And I had one of the early luggable computers, which was an Osborne computer. Just worked on mainly, during my career, I had some jobs in marketing and in product management, but mainly my love was always developing software. You know, I loved working on the development of a piece of software and then seeing people use it and being happy with it. That was a great motivator for me.
Well, and of course, you've seen so many different kinds of advances, much not just the whole physical issue of computers and so on, going from the big, huge things that were programmed by patch boards that you would just plug into slots and the disk drives that we talked about. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was a student at Palmdale High School and was a lab assistant for our physics professor. And one day he asked me to take some time, and he had these big patch boards. He said, just take all the wires out of the patch board, which was a major struggle in and of itself because they were in there, but it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But computers have progressed physically. So now, of course, one of those patch boards wouldn't even be a small fraction of what goes on a chip.
Oh, no. But when I think back to the mainframe days, IBM's, I think, last large commercial computer was the 370-158.
Yeah.
iPhone is orders of magnitude more powerful than that machine, which cost $2 million or thereabouts.
I remember at UC Irvine, we had an IBM 360 and we had a PDP-10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were great machines, those PDP-10 machines, as long as you didn't cut your fingers on the paper tape.
Yes. And as long as you were careful about putting the deck tape in the right way.
Yes.
Well, so now, of course, the other part about computers is how software has advanced. And as you said, the iPhone is magnitudes more powerful than the 370. And we started hearing even in the mid 70s about computers learning what we now call artificial intelligence. I worked with Ray Kurzweil as he was developing the original Kurzweil reading machine. And the thing about the reading machine was that it also did learn. And you could start scanning a page with the computer. And of course, scanning was totally different then. You had to build up a page of text line by line with a camera, literally scanning each line, then moving down a little bit and scanning the next part until you got a whole page, as opposed to just taking a shot. But as it scanned and as you read, the machine really did learn something about the text and the print. And Ray had done what at that time were probably very simple, but still steps to allow the machine to learn to read better is the more you read a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kurzweil is a genius. You're lucky to have worked with him.
Of course, he went on and did other things after he sold Kurzweil Computer Products, but it still was very creative and clever to be able to have a machine even then that learned. And as a user of the machine and then helping with the original testing and evaluation, as I read books with it, it was clearly obvious that it learned as it went along. It literally would read pages better the more it read. And then I could go back and read a page that I had read and just see how much better it was after reading several pages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
And now, of course, it's a whole different ballgame in terms of what artificial intelligence does and can do.
And its availability.
But it's interesting to see how things are improving and getting better over time. And it will be fun to really see what happens as machines learn and so on. I'm not a fan of Ray Kurzweil's singularity necessarily. I'm not sure that we're going to marry the brain and artificial intelligence together, although probably we'll try, but I don't know whether that will be a good thing or not, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, certainly even if one can't map the brain and download it to a computer, I could still see a possibility of a brain being connected to directly connected to a computer and living inside a robot.
Sure.
So, which is a pretty scary thought.
What were some of the last projects you did in terms of software development?
The last major project that I did was a system that would would put all of an organization's manuals online and searchable. So the basic idea was, and hospitals were a target market for us. The basic idea was that you could take all of your manuals as, you know, PDFs and Word documents and JPEGs and whatever you really wanted, and you put them all into our system. You just upload them to our system and create a structure for a set for all of the manuals of your organization. And you could search all of the manuals in very sophisticated ways, more flexible even than Google searching is. You could say things like, I want to find a document that has the word heart and catheter within 5 words of each other, and it would instantly present that document or documents to you. And it had all sorts of built-in security, so you were only allowed to search for what you needed. But it meant that anyone in a hospital had access to all the documents that exist, all the manuals that existed in that hospital. At that time, it was a problem finding manuals. You know, people would spend an hour searching for a particular manual to do a procedure. So that was the last big project that I worked on.
And you said that the manuals typically were in like JPEG format or something like that?
Usually they were Word or a PDF. But, you know, sometimes they would have JPEGs that were associated with the Word documents or the PDF documents.
Of course,
it couldn't search the JPEGs.
Well, I was wondering about that. Of course, today now, even more people are demanding that the documents are accessible. The Google, of course, had the large library of millions of books that it inherited, and they were just going to put them up as pictures. And it took a court fight to get Google to agree and / be compelled to put the documents up as accessible documents.
Yeah, that's I didn't know about that. That's I'm glad the courts did that.
It's all about inclusion, of course, and well, they are, and other organizations are beginning to work on that now. Of course, in this country, it's not quite as stringent in Canada yet, but in this country, within the last month, the government has said that the Americans with Disabilities Act does apply to websites, because a lot of times lawyers have been making the case or trying to make the case, well, the ADA was passed before the internet, so how can websites be held accountable and responsible for being accessible? Clearly, the ADA doesn't apply. And a number of us have said, well, of course it does. Now, of course, the government has finally said, yes, it does. But Congress still needs to stiffen the laws, and that will be another story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for yes, getting Congress to move is not always easy.
Yeah, well, it's as bad as what can entropy be reversed. But and maybe the ultimate question will be the same. We'll have the same answer. We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, so you worked at that until you were 60. So what was that, 2003 or so?
Yeah. Yeah. It was about the company failed to get its last financing because of the burst of the tech bubble in 2003. And that's when I started to think about other options.
So what other option did you decide upon to reverse your entropy? Aren't difficult. Well, maybe to expand, or maybe to see entropy enlarge or grow.
Yes.
I don't think that most people probably understand that whole joke, and it's a physics.
I know.
And basically, the law is that entropy can't be reversed, and things are constantly expanding, like the universe is constantly expanding. And you know, it's like Murphy's Law, which is if anything can go wrong, it will.
It will go wrong.
And then there's O'Toole's commentary on Murphy's Law, which was Murphy was an optimist. But then the other one, which is the commentary on Murphy's Law that says once you open a can of worms, you can only put the worms back in a bigger can. So
yeah.
So maybe it's entropy continued to expand for you.
Yeah. Well, just on the subject of entropy, it's probably one of the worst understood words by the general public. But it was interesting. Whenever a company folds, the first thing that you do is start looking for contracting work, which is what I did. I got on the phone, started calling people. And this particular day, it was in March of 2003, I had finished talking to a bunch of people, and I put down the phone and I opened a Word document because I'd had this idea in my head for quite a while. And it was about a strange plague hitting the earth. It was a kind of an apocalyptic sort of tale. And I started writing. This was about 3 in the afternoon. I started writing and I just kept on writing. And suddenly it was, I don't know, 1 in the morning or something. And I'd just written for 8 hours. And I'd written thousands of words. And I thought, wow, this is the most fun I have had for such a long time. And that's how it all started. That book I kind of ran out of steam on. So I started a different book, and the second book was going nowhere. So I started a book about an assassin, and it just wasn't, that book became boring. Though I did use the opening chapters in another book that in one of my Cal Rogan books. Then finally, I got an idea for a kind of a business thriller that I had in an area in which I had some experience. Where somebody I know was conned by a venture capital company. They called themselves a venture capital company. So I wrote a novel based on that. And I actually finished it. It was the first thing I actually finished completely. And I was quite happy with it. I thought it was pretty good. So I sent out query letters to, I think it was 70 literary agents and a bunch of publishers, and got back 70 rejection letters.
and no thanks.
Yes, exactly. And this was before the day that you could submit via the internet.
Right.
Publishing was really quick, really slow to adopt technology. So as luck would have it, I booked myself into a writer's conference. And I thought, well, this book is good. I mean, it's just I don't know how to market it. That's the problem. So I went to the writers' conference, and the first day, all the sessions were about the art of writing. And you know, I went, took those courses, and realized that marketing wasn't the problem. The book was the problem. And it was just that I didn't really understand how to write a book. I assumed because I was an avid reader that I would be a natural writer. But as luck would have it, at that conference, I met an editor who gave me a 37-page report on the book. And I decided that the book was a non-starter. But through that editor, she was wonderful, and she mentored me through my first real book. And it all started because I was doing a contract in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is the dodgy area of town. And every day I'd walk past this alley to get to the office I was working in. And this alley was full of drug addicts. And I remember saying to my editor, whose name was Lisa, I said, gosh, I go past this alley every day and I keep thinking, how awful would it be to wake up in that alley, which was just awful, just terrible place. And she said, well, who would wake up in an alley like that? And I said, well, if it were a lawyer, that would be kind of ironic. And if it were a businessman, would be interesting. But then I thought, well, if it were a cop, that would be great. And so I had this idea of a cop waking up in a alley full of drug addicts covered in blood. And Lisa asked me a bunch of questions. And my first novel, which is called Junkie, started to come together in my head. And she mentored me through that novel and the second one. And that's grown into a series of 7 books now.
Are they self-published or traditionally published?
They're self-published. I tried going the traditional publishing route. I got some interest, but I think my age was working against me, because publishers are more interested in people who are, you know, younger than I am, and who will have lots of books in them. So anyway, I learned about self-publishing, took a bunch of courses, and went that route. And now I think if a publisher came to me and made me an offer, unless it was a really good offer, I don't think I'd be interested.
But you now have 7 books, so you've clearly established a track record. And the fact that you keep writing them, I'm sure, is in part because you want to. But I would also suspect that you've had success with them.
Yeah, I've had some success with them. And, you know, that somebody asked me, when are you going to stop writing? I'm 77 now. So they asked me, when are you going to stop writing? And I paraphrased Charlton Heston and said, when they prize the computer out of my cold, dead hands. So I'm just going to keep doing it. And one of the main reasons I do it is, over the years, I've established a mailing list of people who are fans of my books. And the feedback I get from those people is just wonderful. I've met so many wonderful people through this mailing list, and they are the people that keep me going. When I have bad times, it's those people who make me feel that I can still do this.
Do you publish through Amazon, or how do you publish?
Amazon, yeah. I decided to go exclusive with Amazon, because when I was publishing through Amazon and Kobo and Apple and Google and Barnes & Noble, I did an experiment with a couple of books and made them exclusive to Amazon, and they just did so much better. So I decided to go exclusive with Amazon on all the books.
Can't you also, though, when you're publishing through Amazon, I assume it's Kindle Direct Publishing, or can't you also make the books available from Amazon through other distribution channels and so on?
Yes, you can. Yes. And Amazon will do that too. Also, Amazon, another reason for being with Amazon is that they also do the books in paperback and in hardcover now. So I've got all of my books are in paperback and in large print. So that's one of the things that Amazon does, which I like.
So have any of them been also produced in audio?
Not yet. And I really want to do them in audio, but I have a particular problem in doing them in audio, because the books are written in first person, present tense, from the point of view of multiple characters. So some chapters will be written from the point of view of a woman's, for example, and some even from a child. And they'll be saying, I'm standing here waiting for Cal, and he's late again. So I need a woman actress to voice those chapters. So it means that in order to do audiobooks, I need to put together a team. Well, I did have a stint of acting, so I do know a bunch of actors. So I will do that at some point, but and hopefully soon. But right now, I'm just so busy that I can't devote the time to it.
Well, I'm thinking, though, that with the fact that you're going through Amazon, it would be interesting to see if you could raise a discussion with them about it being published through Audible, which is owned by Amazon, because Audible has produced, they have done what they call Audible Originals, and they're very capable and do oftentimes use more than one person to deal with the book.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, there's a lot of that.
So, because my thought was that I would, I know how to edit audio and video. I thought of, assembling the actors and getting them to read the chapters and then editing it into an audible book, which, Amazon will let you do. But so they're called Amazon Audible Originals, did you say?
Well, Audible Originals are books that are not traditionally published elsewhere, but they're mm-hmm. published through Audible. Mm-hmm. Do you use Audible at all?
No, I don't. Okay. I'm not an audiobook.
That's fine. We won't hold user. Against you too much. and it doesn't violate the laws of robotics. But in your case, I'm sure it would be called an Audible original because it's not published anywhere through traditional publishing, although your books are. So either way, though, they do produce audiobooks and oftentimes have at least two people reading it, if not more. I remember one that I read last year. You've seen the movie Alien?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so there's a book called Alien Shadows, which is another one where, what's Sigourney Weaver's character's name? And the cat.
Yeah.
they were in suspended animation, and they're brought out of suspended animation for something, and they end up fighting aliens again. And there are like about 10 different actors that are dealing with all the different characters. So I really think that it would be interesting to explore whether Audible could do it and would do
it. Yeah, I'll certainly look into that. Thank you.
I would think that would make a lot of sense to do.
Mm.
I do a lot of audio reading on airplanes, but nowadays mostly not opposed to Braille, because I believe that Braille is still the basic means of reading and writing that I have. Mm-hmm. But my wife and I read books together.
Oh, nice.
So we pipe them through the house. So whatever we're doing, there's a book going, usually not TV, but a book. She's learned how to listen to audio and not fall asleep, so she can follow the book.
That's great.
Yeah, it's really wonderful when a number of actors do it. And there are some actors that can do a number of voices, but I understand what you're saying for your book, but I would definitely explore audio through Audible and see what you could do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I will definitely do that. Thank you.
I think it would make a lot of sense to do. Well, so you were an actor, software developer, actor, and then reader. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, when I was five, I wanted to be a cowboy. But my first job that I wanted to do is I wanted to be an actor. And my father, probably quite rightly, talked me out of it and said, with your mathematical ability, you should do something else. And actually, to some extent, he was instrumental in pointing me towards computers. Or encouraging me towards computers, should I say. But I always liked acting. I was in every school, every play my school ever produced. And after school, I did a few few plays and musicals. So in my 50s, I thought I'd like to try acting. So I took a course and went for auditions and found myself getting lead roles pretty quickly in local theatre. And then I kind of realised I needed a better acting coach. So I took lessons from Larry Silverberg, who is a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And he was in Seattle, and twice a week I would drive down to Seattle and do courses with Larry. And then I'd started doing a few movie things. Then I just kind of realized that acting, no matter how good an actor you are, in the world of movies, it's they're always looking for a look. And I didn't have one, plus, or didn't have the one they wanted. Plus, the movies that are made in Vancouver are all for American audiences, almost mm-hmm. all. And they needed people with American accents. And although I can do an American accent, it's just not very good. So I decided that pursuing that as a profession was not a good idea. So I continued acting in local theater for a while. But once I started writing, that just completely took all my spare time. So that's when I stopped acting.
There's always radio for the BBC or the CBC.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't mind doing radio. Yeah.
That'd be fun. Mm. So what's your next book?
The next book was inspired by a podcast that I listened to. I'm a bit of a podcast addict. And it was about an amazing but quite evil woman who ran this cryptocurrency scam. Mm. And I thought that would be an interesting part of a book. And so that's the next book in the Cal Rogan series that I'm starting to write. Plus, I've got another series of books on the development stage. And my protagonist has a 12-year-old daughter. And so the next series of books will be her as a detective in the year 2040, 2045. When she's grown up, because in the current series, she's 12 years old. So I'm very interested in what the near future holds for us with robotics and artificial intelligence and the social issues that we're facing and social media and cryptocurrencies and all of those things. So I'm very excited about writing books set 25 years in the future.
Have you ever read any of the books by J.D. Robb, the End Death series?
I haven't. No.
So J.D. Robb, who is Nora Roberts, mm-hmm. Has written a whole series there, the Eve Dallas series, and I think they're now 54 or 55 books.
Oh.
And they start out in like 2058, I think, or 2057, mm-hmm. and they're fun to read. There are some steamy parts, but that's okay. They have absolutely captured, well, both me and my wife's attention. So she doesn't even want to read those piped through the house. She wants to read those on her own, but she wants the audio version. So mm-hmm. we are both now on book number 20 in that series, but they're fun. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that your take will be different, and that's a good thing. So it sounds mm-hmm. like a wonderful series to write, but she has been very successful with that.
Oh, that's great. I'll definitely. I knew that Nora had started writing books under the J.D. Robb, but I didn't know anything about them. So I will check out the Eve Dallas series.
They're all They're all something in death, and mm-hmm. they're fascinating. The characters evolve and grow, and the whole series has been very fascinating to observe character development in because of mm-hmm. what she's done with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm anxious to read yours as well now. So definitely get them out there and also get them out in audio. That'll be a lot of fun for a lot of people.
For sure.
Actually, something that you might think about is the Library of Congress has the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Impaired. And I'm sure there is an equivalent in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They also use their own readers to record books, and it might be worth reaching out to them to see if they might be interested. I've not seen any that they individually record that have several actors, but nevertheless, it's a fascinating thing. But I would still think Audible would be the best way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll definitely look into that Audible Originals idea. That would be great.
Well, tell me more about sort of your view about self-publishing as opposed to traditional publishing and the differences and the values and so on.
Well, I'm not a huge expert in traditional publishing. I know people who are both traditionally published and self-published. And generally prefer the self-published side of their work. Traditional publishing is going through, you know, some huge upheavals, and they've been very slow to react to the ebook market, and they just don't seem to have got it. Their books. One of the key things about the ebook market is books should be cheaper when they're ebooks than on paper. But frequently, the traditional publishers will have the ebook and the paper book at the same price. And it seems like they're trying to grab all the money they can out of the marketplace before it's lost to them. Mm-hmm. So now I might well be wrong. But that's a bit how I see it. If somebody came to me and said, I want to be an author, which way should I go? I would say, if you're going to choose, go with self-publishing. You have more control. You make, you make more money. A mid-list author with a publishing house doesn't make a heck of a lot of money. But a mid-list author on KDP with Amazon can make a very nice living. So I've become a big fan of self-publishing.
And the more you learn how to market, the better you will be and the more successful you will be. And it is true that with self-publishing, you have to do more of your marketing. But even in the regular publishing world today, authors aren't usually selected that can't bring their own marketing skills and marketing presence to a book. They want mm-hmm. you to have significant social media presence, mm-hmm. newsletters, blogs, Facebook and social media outreach, and so on. That you, again, bring yourself, much less what they might do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gone are the days when you signed a deal with a publisher, went back home and started writing the next book, and they did everything.
Yeah, very much so. So tell me about your writing process, your style, and so on.
Yeah, it's a bit weird, which...
I know you talked a little bit about it, but...
Yeah, goes with my personality. I don't do a lot of planning of a book. I tend to write by the seat of my pants, as they say. So I'll get an idea for a book and I'll kind of do a mind map of where I think it's going and what it's going to be like and who's going to be in it. And just, I don't even always know how it's going to end. But once I've kind of got it settled in my gut, I just start writing. And I write and things happen. And now, of course, I have a cast of characters who are in most of the books. And when they show up, I know what to do with them. And it's a lot of fun. And I frequently surprise myself. You know, I'll be writing thinking that this chapter is going to end a certain way. And then somebody will say something and it will trigger something in my mind and the chapter will go in a quite different direction. Now, this can be difficult because you can write yourself into a corner, and sometimes it takes a while to get out of it. But I always think if I can surprise myself, I can surprise my readers. So it seems to work for me. And I really like working this way. I did one time just for fun think about planning out a book. Some people, you know, they know how many chapters it's going to be, what's going to happen in each chapter. And I started to do that and, you know, my head exploded. I just couldn't do it. So, sorry, go on.
Your characters are begging to tell the story.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, sometimes somebody will ask a question and I'll think, hey, what would be an interesting answer to that question that I just wrote down? And that might send something in a completely different direction. The other thing is, sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, the other thing is that one of the things that I learned from the literary agent and author, Don Mass, is that every book should have tension on every page. And so when I'm not fixed in what has to happen in a chapter, I can make tension appear on a page by somebody giving an odd answer or asking a question that nobody's got the answer to. And all those things create tension, but they sometimes drive the story in a different direction. So that works, really works for me.
Does it sometimes surprise you when that happens?
Oh, yeah. I'm constantly surprised. Sometimes, you know, at the end of a day of writing, I'll look at what I've written and say, wow, that was good, but different.
Have you ever had writer's block?
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That probably must be depressing after a while.
It is. And I'm subject to depression as well. And sometimes writer's block will be one of the triggers. But I usually get writer's block because I've let the storyline go in a really interesting direction and have a really unexpected, you know, I've been working towards an expected result, and I've thought, no, this unexpected result would be much better. And then sometimes takes me a long time to regather the strands of the story with this new element in it. And, you know, that can take, a couple of days to work out. But yeah, it's except when I'm in a long period of depression, writer's block may last a day or so.
How do you get over it? What happens?
Well, in the short-term writer's block, eventually something will click. You know, sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and think something and, wow, that might work in the book. And so that will happen. When I get into a longer period of depression, the writer's block becomes semi-permanent. And what gets me out of that is I'll end up going to my doctor and he'll give me some medication. So
until you allow yourself to relax and start to just really think about it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And listen to your characters.
Yeah. Yeah. In a recent depression, something happened that helped quite a lot is I woke up in the morning and I was still half asleep. And I had this image of two women standing over looking down at a dead body. And I built a whole chapter in my mind about it. And as soon as I got up, I actually wrote down first 500 words of the chapter. And it was indicative of being in a depression because it was very, very dark. But I thought, you know, if I didn't make it quite so dark, it could actually be an interesting start to a story. So things like that help. You know, stuff pops into your mind and you think, wow.
Well, I'm looking forward to checking out some of the books, certainly. And I can't end this without asking you what kinds of thoughts and observations and advice you might have for people who want to write.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should ask that. I've just finished a guest blog post for a blogger in the United Kingdom. And the title is What to Do for an Aspiring Writer. And my advice would be that if you're, don't think that you're just going to be a writer. The chances are you're going to be a publisher too, and you're going to need to be good at it and good at marketing too. But the thing that will distinguish you over the long term is good writing. So if you don't have experience in writing, don't do what I did. Don't assume because you're an avid reader that you're going to be a good writer. I didn't waste, but I used up quite a few years writing when I could have done a lot better. So make sure you go. Writers' conferences are great things to go to for an aspiring writer, because they have courses which are given by actual published successful authors on how to write. You can meet agents, you can meet editors, you can meet publishers, but take as many courses as you can on the craft of writing. Read as many books as you can on the craft of writing. And just become a very, very good writer. Because at the moment, self-publishing is what is the Wild West. Right. But that's not going to last forever. And the good writers will be the ones who stay in and rise to the top. Now, you've still got to be a good marketer and a publisher. But I think the key is to become a very, very good writer. And if you can go to, somebody I know went to a conference, they met one of their favorite authors and asked the author if they would become their mentor, and they said yes. So that's something that is always worth doing. Because if you have a mentor, I was lucky that Lisa, my editor, became my mentor. And, I could call her any time and ask her any question about writing, and she would tell me. So a mentor is really good if you can get one.
Do you work with an agent today?
I don't work with an agent, no.
Because it's all self-publishing.
It's all self-published. Yeah, but I do use editors.
And there's a lot of value in editors. Good editors are going to help you really bring out what is important and relevant about your book.
Mm-hmm.
Not just tell you how to rewrite something or whatever. I remember when we did Thunderdog, we had a wonderful editor. And Chad said up front, I'm not going to try to rewrite this book. This has to be you and your story and your style. But what I need to do is to help you enhance it to make it something that people will want to read and will connect with them. And he had some great suggestions about transitions and so on in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you have you read Thunderdog?
Not yet. No, it's on my list.
Oh, cool. Well, one of the things that we do in Thunderdog is we start off with something that happened on September 11th, and then we transition back to things in my life that are relevant to that and taught me something that I could then use to do that event. And then at the end of the chapter, we go back to that event, finish it, and then go to the next chapter and do the same thing. And Chad said, well, the problem is I get lost with the transitions. I don't know where I am. I'm suddenly somewhere else. The transitions are not very good. That's a fair comment as opposed to, well, you got to rewrite all of this and all that. He said, the transitions aren't good. So I actually spent a weekend working on the transitions. Once he taught me what that meant, and the transitions became, I think, one of the better parts of the book, and others have said the same thing. And that's one of the things that an editor should do, is really help good writers become even better writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I had an experience with an editor on my third book. Lisa was involved in a couple of other projects, and she couldn't be my editor for that book. And so I found another editor. Who was really, really wonderful. And the book I mentioned about the assassin that never went anywhere, the first chapter of that book was great. And I used it in the new book. And it was a long, long chapter. And it was a flash forward. After that chapter, it flashed back 14 days to see how one got to that situation. And the editor said, that chapter is way too long. And so I broke it up into three different chapters and flashed back after each chapter. And it really, really worked. And, but just to know that the chapter was too long, that's all she had to say to make me fix it, which was really great. And she had a lot of other really good comments as well, where somebody was acting out of character. Would that person really do that? And I thought, no, they probably wouldn't. So, yeah.
That's the sign of a good editor.
Oh, she was great. Yeah.
Well, if people want to reach out to you, learn about the books and other things like that, how do they do that?
The best thing to do is to go to robertpfrench.com. That's my website. And if you first page is a list of my books. The book Junkie is the first book in the series. And if you click on that, I'll send you a free copy of the first book. So if anyone's interested in following up, that's the way to do it.
And is that's the best way then to contact you as opposed to email or something like that?
On my website, just click contact and then, then my email address is there and people can email me.
And they can learn all about any social media that you have and so on.
Yeah, I've got Facebook. Robert P. French, author.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us your insights and demonstrating that you took up challenges that came in your life and you worked through them. And even with depression and so on that comes up, you're able to eventually get past it. So don't stop doing that. We don't want a depressed Robert around.
No one does.
But we're really glad that you came here and you're talking with us. And I appreciate it very much. And so people can go to robertpfrench.com and get all the information. And I hope they buy your books.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you very much for inviting me onto the podcast. I really appreciate it. And just as an aside, I did, after our first conversation, I did go to accessibility.com, and it was really very interesting. So I'm glad you made that connection for me.
Well, I hope that you'll use it to work on your website if you haven't yet.
I certainly will. Yes.
It works well.
Yeah. I was very impressed with their demo.
Well, thanks for being here. And I want to thank all of you who listened today. I learned a lot and enjoy talking with authors. It's fun to compare notes. And it's also fun to talk about the good old days of computers and such things. So thanks very much for doing that, Robert. And again, thank all of you for listening. If you'd like to reach out to me, it's easy. You can go to www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is michaelhingson.com/podcast. Or you can email me and you're welcome to do so at Michael, michaelhi, at accessibe.com. And wherever you're listening to this, please give us a 5-star rating. We really appreciate your ratings and thank you very much for doing that. So again, thanks for being here. And Robert, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset Podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.